Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Cypherpunk. Today we have another special guest with us, Patrick Tagora, who is the author of the Loom system. You there, Patrick?
Yes.
All right. Yeah, welcome to the show. I guess we're going to be talking about how people can build shopping carts or use their own code to enter into this Loom grid and move stuff between different locations and the like, and extend the Loom system.
Right.
Well,
that's
we'll
right.
be back in a few minutes. Speaking of Loom and the grid, here is a song by Crystal Method called The Grid from the latest movie, Fun.
A digital frontier. One day, I got it.
We'll be right back.
we're back. Patrick, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. Well, we have a little bit of a audio issue today, but we're going to just push through this. So, just to get started here, I hope everyone has. If you haven't, go back and check out some of our Loom episodes. We have Introduction, Loom for Geeks, and the like, and today is another episode for geeks. Patrick, tell us about this Loom API. What is this?
Okay, this is the very basis, the very heart of the Loom system. The user interface you see is just built around this API. And as everyone, all the geeks know, the API stands for Application Programming Interface, which allows you as a programmer to control the Loom system using a program instead of using the user interface. So at the core of Loom, we have a couple of concepts called the grid and the archive. And I'm going to focus on the grid a little bit. What I want to do is cut to the chase and answer the question of how one would do a shopping cart.
Yeah, that sounds good.
I'll cut to the chase then on this. Now, here you are, you're a programmer. Someone has told you, please would you do a Loom shopping cart for me? Okay. Well, this is some business. Let's say they're selling coffee, just as an example, and they've hired you to do the Loom API integration, the shopping cart. Okay, well, Loom acts very much like a credit card system, except there's no credit involved. Now, let's just say it acts more like a debit card system, in the sense that you go and buy your coffee and add items to the shopping cart normally, and then you click the proceed to checkout button normally. When you go to pay, the way you pay with a debit card is you have a little form there that says enter your debit card number. And it also says enter an expiration date usually. Well, Loom is very much like that. So it ought to be a familiar model to programmers and to customers. And it's exactly like that in the sense that you just enter a number and press the button. People who use shopping carts now and enter a debit card or a credit card number already understand that when they go to checkout and they type in a number and they press pay, the merchant site just debits the charge amount from that card number that the customer provided and says, thank you very much. We'll ship your order within 48 hours. Here, print this for your records, and that's the end of it. Mm-hmm. And a Loom shopping cart should behave exactly like that. In particular, when you pay with a credit card, notice that you don't take the if the customer puts in a Visa card number and presses pay, the shopping cart does not take the user off to the Visa.com website where the customer then logs in with his Visa passphrase. That's not the way it works. You just put in a number and we just debit the number. The merchant site just debits the number. Loom's the same way. So a lot of people get hung up and expect that when the customer goes to pay, we're going to take them to the loom.cc website. There's no need for that. Okay, so here you are. You're the programmer. You're doing the shopping cart interface. So, you know, in addition to the credit card option, because the coffee seller might want to retain the credit card option, you just put down there, pay with Loom. Put a little header down there that says, pay with Loom. And have a little text field that says, enter Loom ID here. And put a text field over there where the customer can copy and paste a contact ID. And now, if the customer elects to pay with Loom and presses the pay button, instead of sending off an instruction to Visa to debit the credit card and put the funds in your merchant account, instead of doing that, you just send an instruction, a single instruction, off to the Loom system. You're going to send an API call, which is called move, and you're going to say, all right, now let's say that the customer is buying $45 worth of coffee. Mm-hmm. And let's assume that we're accepting a Loom asset that's denominated in dollars. We'll just keep it simple and familiar to everyone here. You would send an API call to the loom.cc server that says the action is equal to move. and the quantity is equal to, now this is where it might get a little tricky. The quantity is not going to be equal to 45.00. The quantity is going to be equal probably to 4,500 because this asset type is denominated in pennies, right? Loom doesn't deal in fractional amounts. We've avoided the entire issue of floating point numbers completely. We don't want to deal with them.
Okay.
Right? Everything's an integer in the Loom grid. So you'll move 4,500 pennies, basically. And you'll move it from the customer's ID that they pasted into your form, and you'll move it to the secret ID of the shopping cart. It's your petty cash place. It's a secret place you go. You send that single instruction to the Loom server. It comes back success or failure. If it's success, then you know you've gotten paid. And you say thank you very much, and you mark it as paid in the order queue, successfully paid. If it's a fail, then you mark it as a failure and it requires further attention. It's the same kind of thing you have to do with a merchant account.
Mm-hmm.
And the API call itself is a simple, it's all just HTTP. And I don't care if you use POST or GET. You know, I'm not one of these people who's really religious about the REST philosophy. I really don't care because the Loom API is just key value pairs. That's all it cares about. It doesn't care how you get the key value pairs to it. Just do everything in key value pairs. So if you want to see the detail on how to send this move call, you can look at the documentation online. You can go to loom.cc, go to the secure site, click advanced, and that takes you to the programming material, the programming information, then click grid. And there's this documentation there, and there's also an interactive tutorial where you can test out your calls with a test asset. You scroll down in the documentation to the section titled Move, and you'll see that there are key value pairs there that you have to fill out and then send. And you can literally just call it as HTTPS, loom.cc, *action=move, %type=asset type. *QTY=4,500. Mm-hmm. You can call it that way, no problem.
What are
so
the
that's,
other values?
That's basically, the next one is ORIG, O-R-I-G, and that's the location that you're debiting. We're subtracting 4,500 from that origination location.
Mm-hmm.
And the next parameter is DEST, which is destination location. We'll add 4,500 to DEST location. And that's it. If it comes back success, you're paid.
Okay. I have a few questions before we continue here.
All right.
To the shopping cart example that you gave, you said for the user to paste in their location. Now,
yeah.
Why wouldn't or would, and what is the difference between the merchant giving the user a preset location ID or having the user put in theirs?
Bottom line, there is no difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a number, and I don't really particularly care how the customer got it. I would say it's more likely, for example, if I'm shopping at Capulin Coffee,
mm-hmm.
it's far more likely that I, as a customer, created that drop point.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt that the Capulin Coffee site wants to create a form that says, here's your contact ID. You could do it that way. You could do something like register at Capulin, and it could say, here's the contact ID where you should pay us, and then they could copy and paste that into their Loom wallet and then fund that ID before they went shopping. Could do it that way. Mm-hmm. Hadn't actually considered that. Sounds a little bit unnatural to me. I think the way it should go is this. Here I am, I'm a Loom user. And I see this Capulin Coffee and I want to shop there. Think, okay, that's great. What I'll do is I'll go to contacts and then click create a new contact point. And it gives me a random number automatically. And I just call it Capulin.
Mm-hmm.
Capulin Coffee. Okay. And I press save. And then I can click the pay option and just pay it directly and pay 45.00 Capulin Coffee units. Let's say that's the asset that they're accepting. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Pay that contact point I just created, and then that's all I need. So then I go to Capulin.com, And where it says paste in your contact point, now in my wallet, I just go back to my wallet and view that, click view contact. And I see the location right there. Double click, right click, copy. Then go over to the Kaplan.com, right click, paste into the merchant form.
Right. Okay. A little side note for listeners. Some people would think, why don't I just put up a donation link or payment link or information on my website or my email or the like, and just instead of asking people to give me a shared location, I'll just give everybody the location to pay to. Well, if you do that, you're giving everyone the ability to peek in that location and take the assets out if anyone happened to throw
that's
away.
That's right. You don't say, hey, everybody, put donations into this big pile sitting over here. Because if you could throw money directly into that pile, then you could also take money out of that pile.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way Loom
works. Okay.
So what you do instead is please point us to a pile of assets and we'll move it to the secret pile.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And if they were to do the other route where they said to pay to this particular location, they just need to make sure that they generate a specific location and have that in their system. Now, one question I have is, when you, let's say that you tell a user, well, let's go the other route, because one of them uses the metaphor of, you know, pay to this account ID, basically.
Yeah.
The other one says, give us your debit card number. So, and this is a technical show, so we're going to flip all over the place here. If you were taking the metaphor of pay to this account, when they opened up their Loom system, wouldn't they need to have added that asset of or that location? How would they go about adding this for users visually seeing this in their head?
Are you talking about the asset that the particular vendor accepts, the merchant accepts?
No, it wouldn't. I mean the contact point. You explained how you would create it yourself. I would like you to explain how if the vendor themselves was saying pay to this location, the user would copy that location, and then what would they do in the interface?
Right. If you want to go that way, and I'm still thinking this sounds a little unnatural, but it might be a good way to go. We'll
right.
see.
I just want for the programmers out there thinking, this is how.
Okay. Let's say that we did it this that a merchant was doing this way. They displayed this number on the screen that says pay here, pay 45 or whatever you want, pay here. Well, then I would, instead of copying and pasting the ID out of my wallet and into the merchant form, I'd go the other way. So I'd, in the merchant form, I'd double-click, right-click, copy, then go back to my Loom wallet, go into contacts. But this time, instead of create a new contact point, I'd click the thing that says accept a contact point that someone sent to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd click that, and then I'd right-click, paste the ID into my form, and I'd enter a nickname for it and then press save. Okay, and then I could click pay and pay some money to it.
Okay, now take this example a little bit further. Let's say that the merchant only accepts the GSF units. What are those called exactly? What's the official name for GFS?
Yeah, they are GSF. Mm-hmm. GSF, which stands for Global Settlement Foundation. They are the GSF Gold Globals.
Okay, so let's say that the merchant says, sure, you can pay for this, but at this time, the only currency that we accept are GSF Globals paid within the Loom system. So you say, pay 50 GSF Globals to this account.
Right.
And I don't have, let's say I'm the user, and I don't have GSF Globals, the asset type listed inside of my Loom system.
Yep.
Now, of course, that begs the question of, well, how are you going to make the payment in the first place? But let's just say that I want to add that currency in my Loom. What do I need to do as a user when the merchant is telling me I need to use this specific currency?
Right. You probably what will happen is the programmer who's tasked with doing the shopping cart,
mm-hmm.
I would recommend, if that's what the merchant who's hiring you says they want to accept, GSF Gold Globals, I'd recommend this. You say, okay, pay with, instead of saying pay with Loom, which is really a misnomer, that's like saying pay with money. You know, that's kind of ridiculous. Uh-huh. You'd have a section that says pay with, you might say pay with Loom. There may be multiple asset types that the merchant accepts. But let's keep it simple. Pay with GSF Gold Globals. You'd have a section there. And it would say enter your contact point and press the pay button. And then over here on the right, you might put something that says, what are GSF Gold Globals? And you could put a brief description. This is gold. One global is one-tenth of a gram of gold. And I would recommend, and you could also list the asset type description right there on the site.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then the user could copy, double-click, right-click, copy, and paste that into the user's asset list.
Right.
You might want to provide a link to the GSF official website where they will list the asset type also.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more official.
Okay, so they can add this asset type from this little block of text themselves manually. Okay.
That's right.
Great.
And to do that, it's real simple copy and paste. The user just says double-click, right-click, copy, then goes into Assets and clicks Accept an Existing Asset into your wallet. Click that. And then right-click, paste, press Save. It's that mm-hmm. simple.
Right. So a person, to take this example to something that could be more real-world, because rarely is someone going to add an asset to make a payment for something that they don't have. Let's say that you... join this bookseller and used in a previous show the Amazon system giving refunds or affiliate payouts. So you join this website and they say, please enter in your Loom contact location. What would be the proper term that someone would want to use on a website for...
You know what? I've been calling them contact points lately.
Okay.
Pretty consistently through the documentation. Contact point.
Okay, I'll try to stick with that. So it says, enter in your Loom contact point for your store credit and affiliate payout account, whatever. So they would need to, programmer would need to, on that site, they say, don't have that asset type in Loom or whatever. Here's information on how to add it, and basically they would have listed there what you just described, how they would copy and paste the asset type information and add it into their system. And at that point, they could create their shared location if the site didn't already give them one. They create it, and then they pop it in. So now they have the asset type, and they have their shared location. Okay. This is all good.
Mm-hmm. And I think...
Go ahead. No, I was going to move to the next point, so you go ahead.
Well, there's a point on this. I think there can be... I think these contact points can serve another purpose. That is, when I... I guess we'll use the Amazon example. Okay, that's fine. So I go into my wallet, and I say contacts, create a new contact point, call it Amazon... And I add the Amazon asset type, Amazon credits, right? Press save. Okay, so I've got Amazon now. Here's what I recommend that you do if you're this programmer. Also allow the customer to paste in the contact point before checking out. Because that can serve as a user, as a customer ID inside your system. When I go to Amazon.com, assuming they're doing this, I can go in and at any time, not just a checkout, at any time I can copy and paste my contact point into the Amazon system, and it looks that up in Amazon's database and says, welcome back, Patrick, and looks up my balance at Loom using the touch call to look up the balance. It says, you have 123.45 Amazon credits. Welcome back, Patrick. Here's your order history. Here are your suggestions. So instead of going in with a username and passphrase into Amazon's site, I could go in with just a contact point. In a sense, that contact point could be my passphrase. You might want to go that far. I think it's pretty nice.
Yeah.
Before you go on to your subject, one of the reasons I'm starting to recommend that is I think this will be very helpful. When you're in your Loom wallet and you click into your contact list and click Amazon, I intend to put a feature in there, I think this is a good idea, where you can attach a URL to that contact point. And it will say, you can put in https://amazon.com, or just amazon.com. And when you click the link in your Loom wallet, it would automatically open up amazon.com, https://amazon.com, in a new window, and carry in your contact point in a query parameter, ?contact=B9CD, or whatever that is.
Great.
So that means you could just log into your Loom wallet, click a link, and you're at Amazon, and you're logged in at Amazon, and it says, welcome back, Patrick, your balance is 123.45. After that, there's no copy and paste ever. Even at checkout, you just say, yes, I approve this payment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the plan.
Yeah, that's interesting. This next question is related to something that you just brought up in that example, and that is this security of stuff going back and forth. And let's talk on the back end. If you have a website, and this happens a lot, most of these shopping carts that people run are on, let's say, a public server, a shared server at GoDaddy, and they're running PHP and the like on this server. Now, I was programming in the past some shopping carts that tied into systems like Liberty Reserve and Eagles and the like with their back-end API. And one of the security issues that came up is sometimes you'd have to check that a payment was made from the server, and that would require you to have the server storing your login information for your account. For your master account. So it's one thing if you can have an alternate API which does a check if a payment was made and if the comment field or reference ID contains a particular piece of information in it. And that would require an API call that had a separate username and password or access code. But if you leave that wide open, then you can't do this stuff on that type of server. You have to separate them. And let's say one example architecture would be your main website and shopping cart would be taking orders, but you'd have to have another, let's say, dedicated server located off somewhere else that was polling every 30 seconds or something to this public web server to look for a pending transaction check, a pending transaction that needed to be checked, and then it would just pull that information down. You know, basically, this is the reference ID. Yeah. This is the amount. Please check if this is there. The back-end dedicated server would run off with its master password to access to the account, say yes or no, transaction came in, and then post that to the main public server. I mean, that's one of the only ways that you can do that if you are locked in to this API that requires complete account access just to check a balance. Do you have
There are a couple ways to do that, and one simple thing to do is to, let's say you're on one of these shared GoDaddy servers and you're worried about putting your master, you know, the secret master Loom location where all of your treasure for the Capulin or the Amazon site is stored, and it's stored in this one place, and we have to forget Amazon, they're not going to do this, right? They have their own servers, but here's little Capulin.com using some little shared server, and they're worried, well, my goodness, every single order, every time we have an order, we're sweeping these funds to this one place, and now we've got tens of thousands of dollars worth of stuff there, and that's one place is stored on this silly little shared GoDaddy server. That's not good. There's one really simple way around that, and that is to consider that one secret place to be just a petty cash area. Mm-hmm. And you can trust the server to let a few thousand bucks worth pile up there. But then if you're the proprietor of Capulin.com, you log into your Loom wallet, and you've put in that petty cash location as a contact point, and you probably maybe you've named it petty cash, and you see the funds piling up there. So you just log in, and you see them piling up there, and you say, you know what, I better sweep those funds. That's a little too much money on that GoDaddy server. Click, and you claim the assets.
Right. So that's a pretty simple way. An example of how a programmer would do this is on one of his, not his development machines, but one of his back-end, back-office machines, the one that is running inside of his business, not the GoDaddy public website.
Right.
Is
right.
He could have, let's say, a cron job running that would do mm-hmm. this sweep, say, every hour or when it was notified by some mechanism, checking email
sure.
or whatever. It would be notified by this GoDaddy that a transaction was actually made, or XML, RPC, or over, you know, XMPP, the over Jabber, you know. It could be notified mm-hmm. or cron it and rip out that petty cash, and then immediately it could also immediately publish a new location. So every time it rips out.
Oh, that's probably unnecessary. That's probably unnecessary because once it's evacuated of funds, it's pretty safe.
Yeah,
you could do that.
The only reason I was thinking on changing the ID is just so that the I'm thinking of the server being like hacked or that location was found out and then it being used in the future.
It's a good point.
I don't know. I mean, if the server's hacked, then I guess you're screwed anyway. But I'm just thinking.
Sort of maybe. But you're guarding against a data leak, not a complete root hackage. A data leak could be a problem. And if you just swap out that petty cash location every now and then, that protects against a data leak.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, mm-hmm. that was one big question that I had, and that sounds like a very nice solution, is to, you can do the full transaction on the shared server and just consider it just your little, you know, cash that's in the register, and then, you know, wipe that out, you know, using real-world analogies. That's really good, you know. Clean out the cash register like they do every couple hours or when they switch cashiers or whatever. Yeah,
put it in the safe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. Put it in the safe. And then there's Loom also has some very nice transactional features to guard against internet outages during transactions. You might say, well, now if I send this move instruction to move 4,500 units from origin to destination, if it comes back and says success, then everything's fine. If it comes back and says failure, then I know, and it'll tell you why. It'll say maybe there's an insufficient funds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's an easy one. And you say, all right, fine, it failed. But what if it just doesn't respond at all? You send the instruction and it goes into a black hole and you don't get any response.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-oh, what happened? You know, so...
Cue it up.
Now... Yeah, it's kind of a mystery how you handle that. It's an internet. You don't even know if the server got the instruction. Or maybe the server got the instruction and just didn't get the response back to you for some reason because you had an internet outage on the way. Well, there's a simple thing you can do. There's a transactional API, and it's unfortunately it's not documented very well on the FAQ, but if you go to Loom News, I need to do something about that. If you go to Loom News and go to Previous News, this is terrible. But anyway, you can scroll down there and you can see, it's at the top, ACID Transactions Now Enabled. That's ACID stands for, I forgot what it stands for. I don't want to talk about it right now. But it basically means really strong transactions that are guaranteed to either commit, either succeed or fail. What you could do is before you call move, you know, post loom.cc action equals move, what you could do is do a get or a post on loom.cc/trans/begin with no parameters, and then you post the move, and then you call, and then you post trans/commit. And what's good about that is
just a moment. What you just gave three posts, but what type of, is there some type of an ID that marks this transaction?
Good Good question. The answer is no. I rely on Keep Alive. I don't rely on transaction IDs. I actually rely on the socket being up, okay? And a consistent socket connection. Mm-hmm. That way you don't have to mess. What's good about that is anything can be embedded into a transaction, including user interface operations. This is a little mind-bending, but if you begin a transaction in Loom and then you keep the socket alive, you can literally do any command in Loom, and it'll all be subject to the transaction. And then at the end, you just say trans/commit if you're done. Or if you change your mind, you can say trans/cancel, okay, and it will be as if nothing happened. And that way, the rest of the user interface and the rest of the IP doesn't need to know anything about transaction IDs. It just relies on a persistent socket connection.
Okay.
What's nice about this is you send the trans/begin, and just do a get on it. That's simple enough, or a post, doesn't matter, with no parameters. Then you send the move, and then you send a trans/commit. What's good about that is, if the commit returns success, then you know the move succeeded. If the commit returns failure, then it's probably because there was a contention, that there's a real busy system and people are doing really weird things. It's probably a really rare thing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You could just try again. It's harmless, okay? If the commit returns failure, nothing changed. You're fine, okay? Just try again if you want. If you don't receive a response from the commit and you time out or whatever, you can just end the socket connection and say, okay, I'm guaranteed that all the operations just failed, that nothing has changed. Guaranteed.
Yeah.
That's really simple and really safe.
Okay. Well,
what's nice about that?
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm, go ahead. Well, what's nice about that is you can do multiple operations. You could do a move and then another move. You could even do things like store data in the Loom archive, like maybe the order record you're actually storing in the Loom archive instead of your own database. And you can say move, store, you know, read, write, and do all kinds of 5 or 6 operations and then say commit. And either they all happened or none of them happened.
Well, yeah, so you could do 1,000 moves between 500
yep.
locations and then... Then
yep,
you know atomically
right.
do that. Okay.
Yeah.
One question on this transaction stuff is: are you not doing this with regular moves, or it's not necessary because it either happens or it doesn't? Transaction is just necessary for multiple calls.
Transaction is useful even with a single call, just because it gives you the added assurance of knowing that if the internet connection dies in the middle, well, there's not the middle, but if it just dies before you get the response, then you know what happened, namely nothing. If you don't do the transaction, you just don't know. You send the move instruction, you don't get a response, you have no idea what happened. Now, you can try to Sherlock Holmes your way out of that. You can say, well, let me look at the customer's originating location and see if the funds are gone.
Yeah.
Well, that's not perfect, right? Because maybe the user somehow did some crazy time. He took them back, yeah. And then if you look at the petty cash location, what does it mean to say, are the funds there? I mean, you might have had 50 orders come in all at the same time, and you've got this big pile of money, undifferentiated money there. You can't check that. Now, one way around that is to use a different petty cash location for each order.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just make a new random number for each order and store the order in your database first along with the contact point. And don't reveal that to the customer. And then sweep the funds there, and then you could check that. But, you know, and that may be useful in some cases, especially when you want to give a refund. But I don't know. It just seems easier just to go ahead and wrap the trans begin and trans commit.
Okay. Any particular reason why the move command itself doesn't just use the transaction function?
Because what if you wanted to do 100 moves in a row?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, makes sense.
Yeah.
A couple of things related to this. There was if I remember correctly, a Loom system that someone created right off the bat when you had taken this publicly. And it looked like they had wrapped some of the Loom API with a sort of like an eGold type interface. Do you remember that system?
Oh, it's an ancient memory. Yeah, I remember something like it.
I I just kind of wanted to see what the name of that system was and if it was still running.
They kind of wrapped it into an Eagle-like sort of account-like interface.
Yeah.
They did a shopping cart which sort of took you to the Loom site and you kind of put in your ID there.
Yeah, I don't remember details. I just remember the interface.
That's funny. In ancient times, back in 2005, when I first came out with Loom, I actually implemented something like that. And in hindsight, it's just trying way too hard, in my opinion. You're just trying way too hard. It's so simple just to copy and paste one of these IDs into a web form, press go.
Yeah, the reason I was asking was to see if they had used this Loom API or if any libraries were available.
Oh, yeah.
Just to see what they had done. Okay.
I don't know. And I consider it dangerous, that kind of approach dangerous now, because it's rife with phishing risk. You could have, not that Capulin would do this, but you could have some merchant site that says, hey, we're going to take you to loom.cc, and you can log in there and pay us. Well, no, what if they take you to loom.cc, which they control, and now they've got your passphrase. So this way is really nice. We have limited risk. You just fund a debit card, if you will, at one of these contact points, and they can only misuse that amount of funds at the very worst, in the worst case.
Correct.
It's kind of like OAuth, but a lot simpler, I think, where you're just giving them the right to a limited amount of funds out of your wallet.
You said it's like OAuth? What was the word used?
This open authorization API that everyone uses.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now,
this is a lot simpler.
Oh, okay. To you, it's what?
To me, this is a lot simpler. You're just giving them, instead of having all these OAuth tokens and stuff flying around that give people limited access to your wallet, you just make a contact point and put a certain amount of money there, and now you've accomplished that same thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, let's talk about people who have done some libraries based on this API.
Yeah.
Your API currently is just the specification. You don't have any code out there, like a code library, or do you have like your Perl code? Do you have a Perl library specifically for the API?
There is some sample code that I put that, actually works. If you go to news, I've got frequently asked questions, previous news. Where did I put that? Oh, my goodness. Caught me flat-footed on that one. Hold on. Oh, Loom source code. Oh, yeah. Okay, so you go to Loom News and scroll down to help, and I do have a link that says a quick pseudocode guide to the Loom API. And you can click that, and there's this batch of Perl code in there that's all in one file that you can kind of mess with.
Okay.
And it's not bad. Also, you can download, if you're a programmer, you can just download the entire source code for Loom. And there is a program in there called Live Code. Okay, there's a program in there called Test API Demo.
Oh, okay.
Test API Demo. The Loom source code for the...
That's a sample client API right there.
It is. Yep. And what does it do? It says it does a few things. It does a touch on the grid, which goes to a specific location and looks up the balance there. And it tells you the balance. And then it does a move. It rolls a random number and says, well, I'll either move 2 units from A to B or from B to A, whatever. And then it touches a location in the archive, too, to demonstrate looking up a text blob, a piece of text in the archive. Because as you know, there are two APIs here, one for the grid and one for the API. Okay. That's kind of a nice start because it shows you from top to bottom. It's a little cleaner than the code that you link to from Loom, from News, because the code that you link to from News has to put everything into one Perl file. The code here in the Loom source code is nice because it uses some modules. It doesn't have to have everything in one program.
Okay. Great. Let's get up to that. You talked about the two different APIs. Let's cover that in one moment. I wanted to bring up Bill St. Clair, who is the author of the TrueLedger digital cash banking system. You know, I'm getting, there's so many terms out there now for, you know, digital cash, value transfer systems, cryptocurrency. It's difficult to put names on some of these things. I need to talk to Bill and find out what his official term that he likes to call, you know, True Ledger. But he has. Go ahead.
It is True Ledger. Yeah, it's his own system. I think you were about to say that he has some resources for Loom, right?
Yeah, he had a PHP library that he had put together, because I guess before True Ledger, the name was True Bank, and before he had implemented that in Lisp, he was doing his first prototypes and the like in PHP. So, and doing stuff with I guess, I don't know how he was tied in with True Bank, with Loom and the like. I don't remember the details, but he created a library in PHP that accessed the Loom system.
Right.
I kind of remember something inside of his code that was doing a little bit more than just moves. Wasn't he kind of like encrypting and decrypting some blobs, or do you know?
Oh, yeah. He did a lot of things, and the simplest way to see it is to go to BillSt.Clair.com. That's Bill, STCLAIR.com. The, I don't know, sixth link down is called Loom, and you click Loom, and you can see a lot of things there. He wrote a PHP library that just wraps the Loom API calls inside PHP functions called move or buy or sell, that kind of thing.
Right.
And he also wrote an iPhone interface, which, and he wrote that in PHP, where you can, if you trust his interface, you could actually log in to a Loom wallet. And he went to the Loom API, grabbed the piece of text out of the archive, and interpreted it the same way that the Loom.cc system does, and rendered the wallet. And you could do payments and everything. He also, on his page here, he has a Loom client Java class. And you can see that there. And he has Java doc. And you can see where he's got move and buy and sell and everything.
So it's basically just a client wrapper in Java for the API.
That's right.
Okay.
Yep.
Quickly.
So you, if you're Perl or PHP or...
Go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying, we've sort of got you covered if you're programming in Perl, PHP, or Java. That's all.
Okay. Do you know if Alex Weed's Pork Loom Ruby project, do you know if his backend is using the same exact API as yours?
I know it is not using the same exact API. A couple things different.
Okay.
He uses these 256-bit locations instead of my measly 128-bit locations. I always chide him about that.
Yes.
He admitted flat out in this interview that says, look, I know that that's just snake oil, basically, but to put it, ooh, I've got twice as many bits.
Yeah.
My point is, if you have a 10-word passphrase, you only have 128 bits of entropy in the passphrase anyway. The 256 doesn't do anybody any good. Enough of that.
Yeah.
But so he has that difference, but he also doesn't use HTTP for his transport mechanism. He uses the thing called Thrift.
Okay. I'm not familiar
with
that.
Apache Thrift. It has a binary line protocol, and it tries to wrap up. Basically, Thrift enables you to create a function signature for an API. You can say, well, we have a buy, we have sell, we have move, touch, look, and it has these parameters, and it kind of builds this code for you and automatically parses and all this good stuff.
Starting to sound like a big fancy Corba thing or something.
Oh, yeah, a little bit Corba, but it's not as bad. I've looked at the Thrift code. It's pretty lean and mean. Uh-huh. But I just thought, well, geez, why not an HTTP interface?
Yeah,
it's so dang cool. You know,
okay.
Frankly, I could support Thrift also. You know, I could support a Thrift protocol. It's no big deal.
Well, the thing
I started with HTTP.
The reason I brought it up was because if he is developing any, maybe he has a client API in Ruby that is for doing these Loom transactions, and it's something that could just plug right into the Loom.cc system.
Here's the thing. It's not that big of a deal. It's just nothing but, if you go to the advanced grid, you go to advanced, and then you go to the advanced tab, and then you go down to grid, it shows you at the very top, look, here's a call You just put in key equals value, key equals value, key equals value. And then you get back a piece of text, content type, text slash plain. And the format is colon key on one line and then a new line, and equals value, colon key equals value. And I put them on separate lines. That actually simplifies some things because you might have values come back with spaces. And I didn't want to get into a bunch of quoting rules. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you can just split on new line. And then every other line is going to be a key and a value. Mm-hmm. You know, that's pretty easy. Just throw it a hash table, whether it's Ruby, Perl, PHP, whatever. It's pretty easy. Split on new lines. Okay. That's it. Put it into a hash table.
We have a few minutes left here. Let me see where we are on this clock here. Yeah, we're running a little tight here. We have a little less than 10 minutes left. There's one little issue I wanted to bring up that I have been running into myself and have been quite shocked and frustrated at finding solutions for right now, and there's not much out there in terms of validating SSL connections between a client and a server at the programming level. And I know we talked about this over the weekend, and we're going to do another show on this, but what I would like to know is, where can users that are interested in playing with this API know that when they're communicating with this backend server that it is who they are talking to? And the most solutions out there are using certificates that are signed by a corporation that is doing certificate authority certs, or even a business. Because let's say that you had a certificate on the Loom API server that was signed by Ray Servers, that I could check the certificate with their CA cert on your connection, the key that's signed with their cert, or your cert that's, you know, signed with their cert. And I could see that they have approved your certificate. And let's say I was using S-Tunnel, where I can specify a particular certificate authority for this cert and not necessarily like this huge bundle of all these massive numbers of certificate authorities that are out there. That's fine, but then that gives Ray Servers the ability to create a man-in-the-middle situation. And I'm not insinuating that I fear that, but it's about trusting the particular site. So what kind of certificate do you have on your API right now?
Right, right. We have loom.cc as the landing page, and you can either click to https://loom.cc or https://secure.loom.cc. The loom.cc is signed by Equifax, and the secure.loom.cc is signed by Ray Servers, CA cert. But both are susceptible to the problems. Again, I don't distrust Ray Servers, but both are potentially susceptible. Let's try to get away from looking at root CA, who signed the certificate. And as you've been brilliantly pointing out, let's start paying attention to the fingerprint.
Right. That's one of the things that I've found is most of for example, S-Tunnel, Curl, all these guys, all the tools that we have to use for programmers out there, they all have verification, but only at the certificate authority level. So one of the projects that I'm looking at is, how can programmers check the fingerprint through some other method without going out and modifying the source code on all of the libraries that are out there? And
As a Perl programmer, I looked into it myself as, well, if I'm using LWP user agent and I'm using Crypt SSL EAY, I think it's called, for my SSL, is there a feature in there to let me check the fingerprint? Oh, I saw all kinds of stuff about checking the certificate, the central authority, but nothing about the dang fingerprint.
Well, you can grab the cert, correct, in that library.
You can grab, yes.
Yeah, right.
You can tell it to verify against this central the certificate authority. That's what you can tell it to do.
I did see in the net HTTPS library in Ruby, there is a command that returns the certificate. So you can do the verify and these little things inside of your pre-execution phase where you're establishing the connection, the handshaking is all going on. and there's a verify there, but you can also return the certificate. Now, if you can return the certificate, then you can, I mean, just to do a hack here, is you can spit that out to the OpenSSL command in a shell, execute a little command here, and that can extract the SHA-1 certificate fingerprint, and then you can look at that and compare it to an embedded or inside of a text file database or wherever you're storing your verification information. And if it fails, then you can exit or abort. If it succeeds, then you just pass. So that's, you know, it's kind of a hack, but at this time, if that's the only thing that can be done in some of these SSL libraries, it's what we have to start looking at doing and implementing on a regular basis.
All these libraries ought to have expected fingerprint equals option.
Yeah, it's insane.
And they just do it. Yeah. Even Google Chrome is pathetic as a browser. I mean, it's a great browser, but they don't have a way to do individual exceptions on certificates and say, I trust this fingerprint.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. There's zero option to do that.
Yeah, the only
Firefox at least has that.
Yeah, at least you have the certificate patrol for Firefox. And then before we get into this, we're going to save this for another show because there are some other solutions that we can do out there. I think that this, there is also another thing that can be done, and that is encrypting the messages with PGP. I'm not suggesting that you do this. I'm just saying that one way that people can bypass the SSL fiasco with certificates is to do message level encryption. And one of the systems that we're all using right now that's fantastic for this is OTR with our messaging. We may have encrypted SSL connections between ourselves and our chat servers, but the way that most of these messaging programs are set up, that stuff can be man in the middle. So with certificates issued by whatever the authority is that the certificate was issued to the chat service providers. SSL, you know.
But OTR has the endpoint fingerprints as well. So
endpoint. OTR, exactly. Yep. It's going point to point. And you could do that with GPG so that messages sent to the server and the replies that are sent back to the server to the user, it's all at a PGP, you know, level.
I could add that to the Loom API as a transport mechanism where you just send a PGP thing, have a make a public key for the Loom API and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be that big a deal. Yeah. We have to fire up GPG.
One other advantage of doing that is that you've abstracted the API to the message format and away from the transport, so it opens it up to alternative transports like XMPP. Which I think, from what I've seen, the voucher safe guys are using that transport.
Oh, neat!
Yeah, so
you're using Jabber. Oh, wow. Okay.
No, don't quote me because I haven't gone into it, but I'm pretty sure that's what they were doing. And I think I was testing with a test version that the programmer was writing a lot. Well, we hope to have him on to go over that.
Yeah, Loom is totally agnostic. Once it gets it into key value pairs, it just runs with it. It doesn't care about the transport mechanism.
Yeah, that's great.
So we could put in more. Yeah.
Okay, we're up at the top of the hour here. Anything you want to cover before we close out here?
I think we've covered it.
Yeah, this has been real good. I know that I appreciate your time right now, and I learned a lot about the system, and while we're talking, even, you know,
I need to beef up the documentation on transbegin and transcommit.
Okay.
I got a little work to do on docs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm sure the other programmers listening enjoyed this. Thank you very much, Patrick, for coming on today. I hope we have you
thank
on
you.
Soon for some other shows.
Thanks, Hero.
Yep. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, everyone. Thank you very much for listening to Cypherpunked. We have a couple more shows coming up with Patrick covering Loom for Geeks and another show that we're going to do with him on GSF, the Global Settlement Foundation system, with their currency, where it's backed and how it's set up and what they're doing with exchangers and look at how they have some of their currency issued inside of the Loom system. Hopefully that'll be coming up within the next week. Thanks for listening.
Dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the Second Realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.